Good morning, and thanks, Ray, for that introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here, to be able to talk to so many of Australia's leading CFOs. This morning, I really want to talk about two transitions. The first is a domestic one, and that's the transition in our own economy following the period of extraordinarily high levels of investment in the resources sector and the record high level of commodity prices. The second transition is a much more international one, and that is what seems to be a transition to a world in which interest rates are noticeably lower than we had previously become used to. And I suspect as CFOs, both of these transitions are of interest to you. So first, the transition in the Australian economy, and I'm sure you're all familiar with the general story here. As you can see, I hope, from this first chart, in the middle of the previous decade, global commodity prices rose very sharply, and that was largely on the back of developments in China. In response, investment in the resources sector in Australia picked up considerably to take advantage of the high prices, and Australia's endowment of natural resources, particularly iron ore, coal and natural gas. These developments were briefly interrupted by the financial crisis, but by 2012, mining investment as a share of GDP had reached the highest level in at least a century. The good news for us is that all this investment has expanded Australia's capital stock and thus our productive capacity. As you can see in this next chart, this is now flowing through into higher resource production and exports, and it will continue to do so for many years to come. In 2014, the tonnage of iron ore exported was double that just 5 years ago, and the tonnage of coal exported was up 40% over that same period. There's also been growth in LNG exports, although the really big increases in that commodity still lie ahead of us. All up, growth in resource exports has contributed around 1 percentage point to annual GDP growth over recent years, and this is expected to continue into the foreseeable future, particularly as these LNG projects come online. However, the really big lift in our capital stock is now drawing to a close, and investment in the resources sector is declining back towards more normal levels. Last year, it fell by 12%, and similar or larger falls are expected this year and in 2016. At the same time, all this increase in supply made possible by the investment both in Australia and overseas has seen the prices of a number of our key exports decline quite considerably over recent months. Importantly, when all this investment in the resource sector was taking place, we avoided the economy overheating as it had done in the past when we had much smaller booms in the resources sector. And looking back, this was a significant achievement. In effect, other parts of the economy made way so that we could accommodate the large addition to our capital stock in the resources sector without overheating. But now we're in a transition to the next phase, and in that new phase, these other parts of the economy should be expected to increase more strongly than they had during the investment boom. Now, in a perfect world, we might expect that this transition could be perfectly seamless. As for non-mining activity to pick up at exactly the right time and exactly the right magnitude to perfectly offset the decline in mining investment. I think in the real world, though, things aren't as simple as that, and it's perhaps unrealistic to expect a transition of this magnitude could be so well fine-tuned as to keep the economy in perfect equilibrium. As you can see from this next chart, over the past 3 years, GDP growth in Australia has averaged 2.5%, and the RBA's latest forecast, which were released just around 10 days ago, had this type of growth continuing for a while yet. Now, while in many other developed economies, growth of 2.5% would be viewed fairly favourably, it's below what we've become used to in Australia, and I think it's below what we're capable of. And as a result, there's been some build-up in spare capacity in the overall economy. So this transition that we're going through isn't exactly seamless. However, we should have confidence that in our flexible market-based economy, we can make a successful transition. Amongst other things, this transition is being assisted by three developments, which I've want to touch on briefly. It's the lower exchange rate, the restraint in aggregate wages growth, and the stimulatory setting of monetary policy. In terms of the exchange rate, over the past 2 years, the Australian dollar has depreciated by around 20% on a trade-weighted basis and around 25% against the US dollar. And we're now starting to see signs that this depreciation is boosting activity in various parts of the economy. One of these is tourism, where exports of travel services are now rising again as more people visit Australia and they spend more money here. Conversely, imports of travel services has declined as Australians holiday domestically more frequently. The lower exchange rate has also improved prospects in a number of other export-oriented industries, including some parts of manufacturing, agriculture, and even in the mining sector. The second factor that's helping with the transition is modest wage growth. As is evident from this next chart, over the past couple of years, aggregate wage growth has slowed noticeably, and it's now running at the slowest pace in many years. While this means that our average living standards are not increasing at the same pace they were during the investment boom, the slower growth in wages is helping to improve the overall competitiveness of our economy. The lower wage growth, by supporting employment growth, is also helping to share the burden of adjustment across the community. I think in this context, it's notable that in the past 9 months, employment growth has been strong enough to keep the unemployment rate broadly steady, even though GDP growth has been below average. And the third factor assisting with this transition is the low level of interest rates. The effects are perhaps clearest in residential construction, which increased by around 8% last year. And as you can see in this chart, building approvals have been at very high levels recently, particularly for apartments, and so we can look forward to further increases in residential construction over the months ahead. The low interest rates are also helping to boost household consumption. They're doing this by improving the net cash flow position of the household sector and by boosting household wealth. However, as I've spoken about on previous occasions, the overall effect on consumption is probably smaller or at least slower than it was in the past. And this is mainly because the high debt levels mean that households are less inclined than they once were to respond to low interest rates by borrowing to increase their spending. Notwithstanding this, there is still a spending response to lower interest rates, and household consumption was up nearly 3% last year. This is slower growth than we saw in the period from the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, but it is faster than the current rate of growth in household real incomes. Now, the part of the transition process that is taking place more slowly than we had earlier expected is the lift in business investment outside the resources sector. As a share of GDP, non-mining business investment remains just above the levels reached in the recession of the early 1990s, and you can see that clearly in this chart. For a few years now, each time the Reserve Bank has updated our forecasts, we've pushed out the timing of the recovery in this part of the economy, and the latest update was no different. Many businesses tell us that while conditions are okay at the moment, they're not sufficiently strong for them to lift their investment plans. Many feel uncertain about the future, and so they're waiting until there's a sustained pickup in demand before committing to new capital spending. There doesn't appear to be a single factor driving this tendency to wait, and there's a similar story seems to be playing out in a number of other advanced economies. Around the world, many businesses seem concerned about the prospects for consumer demand, given the high debt levels that exist in many countries and the aging of the population. There's also uncertainty about what type of capital spending is appropriate in a world where new information technologies are reshaping business models. And many firms also see globalization of markets as a challenge, especially where increased competition has reduced market power. Overall, then, a lift in non-mining investment does remain the critical ingredient to stronger growth in our economy and to a successful transition. Many of the preconditions for this to occur are in place, although a sustained liftoff still seems some way off. And I want to return to this issue in a few moments. Before I do, though, I want to talk a little about the second transition that I mentioned at the outset, that is, to a world in which global interest rates are lower than we had previously become used to. Again, perhaps the best way to see this is with a couple of graphs. This first shows the average policy rate set by the US Federal Reserve, the ECB, and the Bank of Japan. And with all three central banks seeing their policy rates at or very close to zero, the average rate is the lowest on record, as you can see. This next chart shows the yields on 10-year government bonds in the US, Germany, and Japan. Again, in all three cases, the rates are extraordinarily low, despite the increases that we've seen over recent weeks. Now, these very low rates mean that savers investing in risk-free assets earn negative real rates of return. They mean that the time value of money is negative, and they mean there's no compensation for postponing consumption until tomorrow. So how do we find ourselves in this, what can only be described as a remarkable situation? I think the proximate cause is the decisions taken by the world's major central banks to set their policy rates at these historically low levels and to buy unprecedented amounts of assets from the private sector. But of course, central banks don't act in a vacuum. They're responding to the world in which they find themselves. And that world is one in which there's an elevated desire to save relative to the desire to invest. And when the appetite for saving is high, and few people want to use those savings to invest in new assets, the return to saving is, unfortunately, inevitably low. And we should all hope that this period of extraordinarily low interest rates does not persist for too much longer, that over time confidence lifts and once again businesses compete strongly for the world's available pool of savings to fund new productive assets. And once this happens, higher returns will again be offered to savers around the world. My own view is that there is a reasonable prospect that in time this will indeed take place and that some normalisation of interest rates around the world will occur. But I think it's also plausible that the average return on assets, at least for a protracted period, will be lower than it had been previously. The population in many countries is ageing, aggregate household indebtedness is high, and many of the service industries that are growing relatively quickly aren't particularly intensive in physical capital. I think taken together, these trends might be expected to boost the desire to save relative to invest, and thus lead to structurally lower level of global interest rates than would otherwise have been the case. Of course, we can't be sure that things will play out like this. Many other factors influence global saving and investment decisions, particularly what happens in the populous developing countries in Asia. But what we do know is that even if the current low level of interest rates is entirely cyclical and it has no structural element at all, then it's proving to be highly persistent indeed. And as CFOs, I suspect that for many of you, this is complicating your job and posing new questions and new challenges. In this context, I just want to briefly touch on three issues. The first is the challenge that low interest rates pose to anyone who is seeking to fund future liabilities. Low interest rates mean that the present discount of value of these liabilities is higher than it once was. In turn, this means that more assets are needed to cover these liabilities. And for anyone managing a long-tail insurance business or a defined benefit pension scheme, now this is obviously quite a challenge. It's also a challenge for retirees and for those planning for retirement. The second issue is the effect of low interest rates on asset prices. Just as low interest rates increase the value of future liabilities, they increase the value of a given stream of future revenue from an asset. The result of that is higher asset prices. Another way of looking at that is, faced with low rates of return on risk-free assets, investors have sought other assets, and in so doing, they've pushed up the prices of these assets. A good example of this is commercial property in Australia, where investors have been attracted by the relatively high yields, pushing prices up, even though rents are declining. Of course, a general rise in asset prices is part of the monetary transmission mechanism. But developments here need to be watched very carefully. History is littered with examples of unsustainable asset price rises emerging on the back of perfectly justifiable increases in asset prices. In a number of cases, these episodes have ended badly, especially when there's leverage involved. Also, we should not lose sight of the fact that interest rates and the returns generated from assets are ultimately linked to one another. So interest rates may be structurally lower in part because the stream of future income generated from assets is also lower. And this would have obvious implications for the sustainable level of many asset prices. The third issue is the effect of low interest rates on firms' investment decisions and the hurdle rates of return that they use. In today's environment, it seems that many investors have reluctantly come to accept that they will earn lower rates of return on their existing assets. An open question, though, is whether the same acceptance of lower returns is flowing through to firms' decisions about the creation of new assets. That's their own capital spending plans. The international evidence here is that hurdle rates of return that firms use for new investments are quite sticky, and they're not very responsive to movements in interest rates. There's less evidence on this issue in Australia, but a recent survey of CFOs by Deloitte hints at the same conclusion. The survey results suggest that the hurdle rate of return on new investments are typically above 10%, and sometimes considerably so. You can see that in this chart. The results of this survey also suggest that the average margin between the hurdle rate of return and the weighted average cost of capital is about 3 percentage points. And as part of the survey, firms were also asked how often they change the hurdle rate of return, with by far the most frequent answer being very rarely. And these findings are very similar to those reached through the bank through our own very extensive business liaison program. Now, one issue that this raises is what's the appropriate hurdle rate of return in a world of persistently low interest rates? Now, each CFO will no doubt have a different answer to this. But in a world of low interest rates, it may well turn out that the average answer is, or at least should be, lower than it was previously. In a number of countries, you've seen a recent tendency for firms to return funds to shareholders. These firms are effectively saying to their shareholders, here, you manage the money because I don't have investment opportunities that satisfy our hurdle rate of return. And in many cases, shareholders have welcomed this, seeing it as a very disciplined approach by management to capital management. The difficulty is that if the majority of firms act in this way, shareholders in aggregate get left holding the cash. And on that cash, they earn very low rates of return, almost certainly lower than the rate of return that would, on average, be earned if the cash were invested by businesses in real assets. Really, this is just another way of saying that if the appetite for investment by business is low, savers, in the end, will get low returns on their savings. So I said this world of low interest rates is creating challenges for many of you, whether you're a CFO needing to fund future liabilities, a CFO valuing and managing the risk around an asset portfolio, or a CFO determining the appropriate hurdle rate of return for your firm's investment decisions. This world of low interest rates is, of course, also creating challenges for managing the first transition that I spoke about. that in the Australian economy. The large monetary expansion abroad and the low interest rates of the major central banks have meant that the value of the Australian dollar has been higher than would otherwise have been the case. In this context, it's difficult to escape the conclusion that a further depreciation of the Australian dollar would be helpful in the transition of the Australian economy. In this challenging global environment, the RBA is seeking to play a constructive role. As I said earlier, low interest rates are supporting spending in the economy. The further reduction in the cash rate earlier this month will provide a bit more support and it will help reinforce some of the recent encouraging signs, particularly in household spending. In time, the stronger consumption growth and a continuation of a pickup in residential construction should lead to a lift in business investment. It is, however, unlikely to be in Australia's long-term interest to engineer a consumption boom by simply encouraging people to borrow large amounts against their future income. This is especially so when debt levels are already high and prospects for future income growth are not as positive as they once were. So there is a fairly fine line to tread here. The RBA's recent decisions have sought to strike a prudent balance to help encourage consumption growth and thus ultimately business investment, but avoid the type of imbalances that could cause us serious problems later on. And we'll continue to assess that balance very carefully. Of course, the more enduring solution to the two issues I've talked about, the transition in our own economy and the low returns to savings, is an improvement in the underlying business investment environment. This is a challenge, not just here in Australia, but it's a challenge in almost all advanced economies. Unfortunately, there's no magic lever here, but I think the good news is that this task is not an impossible one. On that note, thank you very much for your time, for listening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip. Well, I think Philip's raised about 700 different issues in there for CFOs. If I could just kick in by saying one of the things that you did raise, which is a really difficult issue for CFOs, is reflected by the slide you had on hurdle rates and the pricing of risk and whether there's a lot about capital management returning funds. I'm not sure a lot of the short-termism in our market is pricing risk in, and hopefully CFOs are pricing risk in, and that perhaps reflects those hurdle rates, but also the difficulties that Ian, you might talk to about valuing assets and liabilities and in an accounting sense. So I think there's a myriad of issues there. But we've got a time for a couple of questions, so can I... Firstly, I'll say the media are here, so if you're not supposed to be here and you don't want to identify your name, don't get up. And the media are out of here for this session, but I'm only joking. But any rate, we've got time for a couple of questions, so who'd like to ask Philip a question? Stephen
Mills, Suncorp. Philip, you spoke about the risk aversion and the apparent reluctance of businesses to invest, not only here in Australia but globally. It's a tough question, but do you see any particular catalyst or catalysts that will change that mindset?
As I said, there's no kind of magic lever here. Last year, when Australia, you might recall that Australia chaired the G20, and much of the effort that we put in during that year was to encourage countries right around the world to identify structural reforms that would ultimately improve the business investment climate in their countries. And none of these things, it's not like an on-off switch, but implementing a program of structural reform ultimately improves the business investment climate. So there was a long list of commitments that were entered into by countries around the world. And in Australia, you can the areas where we could do things that I think are pretty well known. It's competition policy, it's innovation policy, it's tax policy, it's labour market reform. None of these things in and of themselves will encourage business to go out immediately and invest, but a commitment to a program of structural reform, I think, in the end, is the best thing that we can do here.
Any other questions?
Carrington Clark from Sky News Business. Philip Lowe, you spoke about the currency helping to support the economy, the devaluing, depreciating by about 20% over 2 years. We have seen a slightly rise. How a danger are we globally for seeing a currency war between the different central banks all trying to bid down their currencies because they all want to give that support to their own economies? And how much does that weigh on the RBA's thinking?
Yeah. I don't like the language of currency wars because I think it's not an accurate representation of what's going on. In most of the developed countries, there's a deficiency of aggregate demand relative to the supply and the economy. And so inflation is low and growth is weak. And central banks are responding to that. So we've got zero interest rates in much of the world and very large purchases of assets by the major central banks. And they're doing that to try and stimulate their economies. Now, one of the channels through which that works is a weaker exchange rate than otherwise would have been the case. But the policies aren't designed to weaken their currencies. They're designed to support growth in their economies. I think that's an important distinction. In Australia, the monetary easings in the rest of the world have meant our currency's been higher, and we've responded to that by having lower interest rates than we otherwise would have had. So I've spoken on other occasions that the configuration that we have with the exchange rate being probably too high and interest rates, that having an implication for interest rates, is not the right kind of, not the optimal configuration, but it's the one we actually have, and we have to deal with that. But I don't see this as kind of countries involving in policies to depreciate their currencies. It's the result of the stimulatory monetary policies they feel like they have to implement, given they're missing both their employment and inflation objectives.
Okay, well, last question. Thanks.
Good morning, Mark Mulligan from Fairfax. Mr. Lowe, you mentioned here the optimal configuration in monetary policy settings. At the same time, that there is some concern about more indebtedness in the households. There's been some debate since the last cash rate decision about whether or not the banks actually sort of pulled back a little bit from its easing bias. All things considered, and the content of your speech, is that a fair assessment that you have actually moved back a bit from what we might consider an easing bias?
Well, you might notice that if you look back through the interest rate decisions of recent years, on the months where we have changed the cash rate, we haven't provided any guidance about what's likely to happen in the future. And I think that's appropriate. The focus on that month is really on the decision rather than what comes in the future. So we still have scope to lower interest rates if we need to. That doesn't mean we're going to, but we have scope to do that if we need to, and nothing has changed in that dimension. But the idea that kind of when we announce a reduction in interest rates that we continue to provide guidance, that's something that we haven't done that in the past, and we want the focus very much on to be on the decision that's taken rather than the prospective changes that might come down the track.